That's okay. It'll work. All right. So today, the class is called How to Detect Fallacies in Your Tactics. And if you guys have noticed, hopefully, maybe you haven't, I've used some hedging language in the past few weeks saying, well, God willing when we get to week 7, or God willing when we get to week 8. Well, apparently God did not will us to have week 7 and week 8. This is going to be our last week in the tactics class, which really provides no problem per se, because we're going to cover all the material that we were going to cover in the last 3 weeks here. So these were the 5 topics that we were going to cover. It's just going to be more in a reduced form. Due to my workload and the academy that's starting next week, I just do not have time to do 3 more weeks. So God is willing us in a different direction, but that's okay. Do not fear. We will not leave anything out. So first of all, we briefly touched on this last week. How to detect fallacies in your tactics. Anybody remember what a fallacy is?
Something that's illogical.
Right. It is an error in our thinking. It's a place where someone has made a mistake in their thinking. So when someone says, that's fallacious, all they mean is that your argument is logically unsustainable. So it sounds meaner than it actually is. It's just, but if you put a little twinge on it, it can count. Yeah, that's fallacious. So having said that, this is what we're going to cover today. Burden of proof. By the way, not all of these are fallacies. Like this burden of proof thing and reductio ad absurdum, those aren't fallacies, but all the middle things are. So we're going to look at this idea of burden of proof. We're going to look at ad hominem. We're going to look at this idea of straw man. And then we're going to look at red herrings. And my favorite of all is reductio ad absurdum. So by the way, I hope, since we are wrapping up today, please ask as many questions as you want. I purposely made this class shorter than other classes so that we could have as much interaction as possible. So, this idea, first of all, of the burden of proof. Now, it's been my experience that when in conversations with non-believers and even professing Christians alike, our challenger will often construct an alternate reality in order to explain away either God or the Scriptures. So does that make sense? When we're talking to them, they would say something like, well, I could imagine a, fill in the blank, a reality that's separate than your reality. So alternate reality versus the reality of God and the Bible and Jesus Christ. Now here's where we sometimes can make a mistake in our tactics. So remember the Socratic method from last week. Avoid making a statement, at least initially, when you can ask a question instead. So this time, instead of asking the standard question, what do you mean by that? The question is slightly modified to, how do you know that? How do you know that? Remember, if you ask a question, you're still in the driver's seat. It feels a little bit out of control when you're in a conversation and someone puts a very plausible, possible reality in front of your eyes and you don't know what to say. Well, don't say anything. Ask a question. How do you know that? And believe me, this is very difficult for me because my personal inclination is to immediately jump on it like a pit bull and argue. But here's the reality, is that Christians are oftentimes accused of believing in fairy tales or making leaps of faith without any evidence or reason. But the reality is that these alternate realities often require bigger leaps of faith that require ignoring reason altogether in order to believe these alternate realities, these tales that they spin. So here's a good general rule to adhere to when thinking about this idea of the burden of proof. So here it is. An alternate explanation is not a refutation. An alternate explanation in itself is not a refutation. In other words, when someone comes up with a tale that explains away the truth, that in and of itself does not refute the truth. It's simply another explanation for reality. So now the question becomes, how do you know that? So we're asking for proof of their claim, and we're putting the burden on them. Instead of taking the burden ourselves and trying to defend Christianity, we're putting the burden on them. They're the one that made the claim. There's no reason for us to try to jump on it. So Greg Kokel, in this book, Tactics, right here, he says this, quote, "The burden of proof is the responsibility someone has to defend or give evidence for his view. Generally, the rule can be summed up this way. Whoever makes the claim bears the burden." You're making the claim. I don't bear the burden. You bear the burden. The key here is to not allow yourself to be thrust into a defensive position when the other person is making the claim. It's not your duty to prove them wrong. It's his duty to prove his claim. So here's an example of what I mean. Consider the events that immediately followed the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. The authorities, remember, sent a guard. Pharisees and Sadducees went to Pilate and said, "Please send a guard, because Jesus warned that he was going to rise from the dead, and if the disciples go and steal his body, then the deception in the latter part will be worse than the first." So Pilate agreed. He said, "Go secure the grave however you need to." So one commentator that I read put the number of guards around 30 to 50, because, remember, they weren't simply guarding against 11 disciples, but rather thousands of disciples in Jerusalem itself. And in Acts 12:14, Peter himself was guarded with 16 Romans. So the fact of the matter is there's more than simply one or two. There was many trained killer Roman guards. So, at any rate, consider the claim. So here's the claim. Jesus didn't rise from the dead because the disciples stole the body. So let's ask three questions when it comes to this idea of burden of proof. So these are questions that we can ask on top of how do you know that, to help draw this out of the person who's making the claim. First of all, we ask, is it possible? Secondly, is it plausible? And then thirdly, we ask, is it probable? So, first of all, is it possible? Is it possible? Remember the claim. Jesus didn't rise from the dead because the disciples came and stole his body. So first of all, is it possible? Is it possible that a bunch of poor, redneck sheep herders and fishermen could outwit or outfight trained Roman soldiers? Is that possible? Secondly, is it plausible? And remember, you're asking them this. This is not your burden. Is it plausible that the disciples who cowered in the garden and denied Christ with their actions would then steal the body of Christ and lie to the whole world that Jesus rose from the dead? And remember that their witness was what ultimately led to their own torturous, gruesome deaths. They could have any moment produced the body and spared themselves the sword, crucifixion, being boiled in oil, and the like. Is it plausible that given all of that evidence that followed, that this was the case? Thirdly, is it probable? Is it probable? Remember, the burden of proof is on the person who's making the claim. They need to demonstrate that their explanation is more probable than yours. Now, of course, our explanation is that Jesus did rise from the dead, and that requires you to believe in supernatural events. Well, if the person you're talking to already has a predisposition towards disbelieving anything supernatural, well, then you should employ the Socratic method and say, how do you know that? Why would you automatically assume that there's no such thing as supernatural events? But at any rate, remember, the burden of proof is on them and they have to give the reason. So sometimes they might say, well, I don't have any reasons for believing that, I just believe it. Well, then you should ask, well, then why should I believe what you say if you don't have any reasons for believing what you believe? People, sometimes we just need to stop, take a deep breath, and think about what they're saying. There's no reason to quickly respond. Let's see, you just said that I actually don't have any reasons to believe what I believe. Well, then good grief, why should I believe what you're saying if you don't have any good reasons? So, having said that, here's the big idea of the day. The big idea is that there are other ways, so I'm using this in a kind of a snarky, sarcastic way from the negative side. There are other ways of winning the argument when the truth is not on your side. So there are other ways of winning the argument when the truth is not on your side. And one of those ways is to make a claim that's an alternate reality and then offer no reasons for it. And so all we're simply, or them offering no reasons for it. So all we're simply doing is calling them on the carpet and forcing them to give us a reason to believe what they believe. All right. Secondly, the ad hominem attack. So we've already learned some Latin words. Anybody knows what ad hominem means?
To the person.
To the person. Or to the man. I'm not sexist. It can mean to the woman, but I think it literally means to the man. So, ad hominem means to the man. And this tactic, it's a wrong tactic. So don't do this. But this happens all the time, and it's really effective. So here's the definition. An ad hominem attack is attacking the person's character or his motives for believing something instead of disproving his argument. So it's an attack on the person not the argument. It's an attack on the person, not on the argument. So consider the following. By the way, I was talking to Michael before class. This book is fantastic. If you guys want a book, it's called The Fallacy Detective. It looks like a little kid's book, because it is. But you know what? Since we grew up in a country that didn't teach logic, this is an adult book. Okay? It says 8 and older. So my son, now granted my son likes to argue, but he sat down and started reading this book and he read like 8 of them in a row and he couldn't put it down. He thought it was so good. So I'm going to read to you an example of this ad hominem attack from this book. So here is a made up conversation, by the way. This is between George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. George Washington: I disagree with my distinguished opponent regarding his view on public housing for minorities. I think that it would be wrong for us to force the taxpayers to fund such an enterprise. Thomas Jefferson responds: I must insist that my opponent is mistaken in his beliefs, and the public should, in fact, disregard them. My reason is that he has been in the military most of his life, and therefore he cannot have compassion for the feelings and needs of minorities. George Washington responds: I must again disagree. My opinion is not influenced by my rank in life and my position in the military. My opponent, however, is not so clean from bias. His desire for public funding for housing for minorities stems from an unbalanced pity for them and his insane desire to further their cause. His opinion cannot be trusted. Thomas Jefferson responds: Whoa! We want to talk about biases, do we? What about your bigoted hatred for the Indians? If that doesn't influence your beliefs about minorities, then I don't know what would. George Washington. My feelings about the Indians have nothing to do with this. But as long as we're going to talk about insinuating things, I'm just wondering what you did on all those trips to France. Nobody seems to know. Thomas Jefferson. What are you doing now? Attacking my character? Have I ever said anything about that cherry tree? So, obviously, everything in that argument, you know, fictitious, of course. But what were they doing? They were attacking the man. Does anybody even remember what the whole argument was about?
Housing for minorities.
What happened? It digressed into a personal attack. So remember the big idea. There are other ways of winning the argument when the truth is not on your side. Again, that's the negative way to look at it. There are other ways of winning the argument when the truth is not on your side. And attacking one's character is an example of this. So this is wrong. So don't do this yourself. But at the same time, don't let your opponent do it. It's not right. So last year, I spoke rather publicly about a false gospel that was being preached at a local church here in town. And the reasons that I gave for this gospel being false were both sound and biblical. And so, guess what? I had some opposition. But what do you suppose those who opposed my view did? They attacked me. They never attacked my argument. Some of the meanest things that I've ever been called in my life came from this particular event. And so, when the firestorm calmed down, I actually met with one of the pastors for coffee at a local Starbucks, and I asked him about the whole situation. So this other pastor was at that particular church that was preaching this particular false gospel. And I just said to him, hey, you know, I think the gospel is pretty important, you know, especially in light of the warnings in Galatians 1. It says, if anybody preaches a false gospel, let him be cursed. I mean, what do you think about this, you know? And he said this. He said, Josh, it seems to me that you have an unhealthy obsession about these things. What is motivating you to pursue this? I think something is wrong with you. Now, I didn't have a response at the time, but I will next time. What could have I said to this particular person? Could have said a lot of different things, right? One way to completely take away the argument would be to say, yeah, you know what? I have tons of things wrong with me. And if you want a long list, just talk to my wife. But that's not what this conversation is about. This conversation is about the gospel. So I can agree with you that there's lots of things wrong with me, but you're totally avoiding the subject, right? But it's very difficult to do that in those situations, and why? Because nobody likes to be attacked. We want to defend ourselves. But if we're talking about things like the gospel, you could just agree. You already know, I mean, what does the gospel tell you? You already know you're a sinner. Good grief, you deserve hell. So why not agree with those things? Yeah, you're right, yeah. Yeah, those things are true, but that doesn't, let's talk about what we're talking about. So that was an ad hominem attack. So, if you respond in a way where you take away their argument, then you're forced to make them deal with it. And I gotta say, it's no wonder why Jesus said things like this. Quote, the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. There's a shrewdness that comes with the sons of this generation, and Jesus commended them in a particular manner for having more shrewdness than we have. And so I think when we are able to take away the argument from those who seek to ignore the gospel altogether, we're being more sure than they are. That's what Jesus is commending. That's in Luke 16:8, if you guys want to look at that later. Alright. The straw man. Any questions on ad hominem? Anybody have examples of ad hominem attacks on themselves? Yeah.
Rarely on the actual issue, it's just sidetracked on. I wonder if they know that they're doing that. If they know that terminology, I'm sure they know the strategy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just an interesting thing.
I think that's, even if they do know what it is, the people don't. Even if they're applying it deceptively, I mean, it's so deceptive. I mean, it's like Jesus said, you know, the sons of this generation are more shrewd than the sons of light. All right, so speaking of politics, the straw man, like ad hominem, is used in politics all the time. So whenever you've heard this phrase, tax cuts for the rich, that is a straw man. Who name me one politician whose goal in life was, you know what, I'm going to increase the taxes on the poor and decrease all the taxes on the rich. Like they're maniacally sitting in a smoke-filled room somewhere. That's a straw man. Okay? So, formally, what's the definition of a straw man since we didn't actually define it yet? The fallacy of the straw man is changing or exaggerating your opponent's position in order to make it easier to refute. So think about straw man. Think about scarecrow. Instead of the actual person, you're setting up a false argument in order to be able to knock it down easily. So remember the big idea? There are other ways of winning the argument when truth is not on your side. So, if your position is too strong for your opponent, he might create a false view and then attribute it to you and then knock it down in order to make an appearance of defeating your argument. And this is not done merely to defeat your argument, but it's also done to get away from the real issue at hand. If you can knock down a false view, then what are you doing? You're never getting to the real thing. So a straw man is also known as a caricature. If you've ever been in the mall or somewhere where you have a cartoon artist drawing cartoon artists, that's a cartoon of you, that's a caricature. So what do? They exaggerate certain parts of you in order to make your personality come out, I guess, or whatever. So a straw man exaggerates, and that's why the straw man is somewhat difficult to see sometimes, because oftentimes what happens is they'll take an element of your argument that's a truth, and then twist that truth and then knock that down. And so in their straw man, there's falsehood and truth in it, and sometimes it's difficult to see that. So let's run through a few different examples of straw men that maybe straw men's happened to you as well before. So I've talked to people who are non-reformed in their thinking, and sometimes they straw man me by saying stuff like this. Well, since you believe in election, then you think that we're robots. Is that our view? Does anybody in this room think that we're robots because we believe in election? No. So where's the truth in the statement? I do believe in election. Where's the falsehood? Therefore, you believe in robots. So how do you stop a straw man? Well, the easiest thing you could just say is, well, that's not my position. I don't hold that. I do believe in election, but it's a non sequitur. Remember from last week. It doesn't necessarily follow that therefore we're robots. Okay, this one's been employed on me before. Well, if you think Calvinism is true, then you hold to the teachings of men. I just believe what the Bible says. So where's the truth and where's the straw man? We can call it whatever we want. We can call it doctrines of grace. We can call it the gospel. We don't need to call it Calvinism. But obviously, if people know what Calvinism is, they could say something like this, right? Right. 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 Well, and it's somewhat ironic. You know, a lot of these statements commit what's called suicide on themselves. Okay? Well, our church doesn't hold to the teachings of men. Our church teaches the Bible. Okay, so let me go into your church then. Are you telling me that when your pastor stands up behind the pulpit, all he does is read the Bible and he doesn't add any comments at all? Because if he adds any comments at all, what is he doing? He's inserting the what? The teachings of men. So their view itself commits suicide on itself. Okay, a third example of a straw man. If you're saved by grace, then you're saying that holiness doesn't matter. Because if grace is what gets us into the kingdom, then it doesn't matter what I do, and therefore holiness doesn't matter. It's a straw man, right? Who in here doesn't believe in holiness? If you've never been accused of these things, maybe you should have more conversations. Because these are common things. I mean, we want to rebel against the gospel. We want to think that there's something left up to us. And if there's not something left up to us, then we can straw man our opponent by saying, well, everything doesn't matter then. And that's just not the case. Anybody have any examples in here of being straw manned before? Michael?
So I think President Obama said something like, what the Republicans want is more, what do you say? Anybody remember this? He said they want less health care for the elderly. They want, you know, a list of things.
Right.
They're all strong men.
Right.
Like that.
Yep.
Ridiculous things that would be easier to refute.
Yep. But unfortunately, we do live in a society of sound bites, and so if you can manipulate the airwaves, then when you're in a country when people can't think anymore, we're in trouble. Yeah, yeah, that's a straw man, and since he's in the front of the classroom, it's a very. Absolutely. Okay, red herrings. Now this fallacy is closely related to the other ones, but it's a kinder, gentler one because it doesn't necessarily attack the person's character and it doesn't necessarily, although it can, set up a false view. Its simple aim, the red herring, is to distract, distract, distract. So what is a red herring? Well, red herring is a dead, stinky fish. That's what it is. A dead, stinky fish. And this fallacy got its name from dog trainers. And what these dog trainers would do when they had, you know, puppies, they would try to train these dogs to be able to get on the scent of an animal and stay on that scent until they found it. So, what they did to try to teach the dog to not be distracted is that, like, say you're on, like, on a trail of a raccoon or whatever, they would take this dead stinky fish and cross the trail with it, you know, ahead of time, and so that when the dog came across this red herring, he would have to choose to either follow the red herring or keep on following the raccoon. So they train him to only stay on the argument, to stay on the scent of the original thing. So what a red herring does in logic, or in fallacies, is people will insert distracting sentences and propositions into the argument in order to take you off of the trail of that raccoon. Right? So formally the definition is it introduces, the red herring introduces an irrelevant point into an argument. And someone may think, or may want us to think, it proves his side, but it really doesn't. So it's an irrelevant point on the one hand because it has nothing to do with the argument, but it's related on some level. So remember the big idea, if the truth is not on your side, then there are other ways of winning the argument, and this fallacy's main purpose is to distract. So to stay on point in your arguments, try to ask two questions. Just do this mentally. What is the topic at hand? And so, actually, there's kind of overlapping circles in these fallacies, if you haven't noticed, because, like, even with the ad hominem attack, when someone talked about my personal character flaws, in a sense, that's a red herring. I could have said, okay, we can get to that topic second, okay? We can get to the nature of my horrible character second, but let's stay the topic at hand. And so then the second question that you should ask yourself mentally is your opponent staying on topic? What's the topic at hand? And obviously, you know, if you've ever heard the phrase rabbit trails, going off on rabbit trails, that's what this is, you know. All right, so imagine. So this would be, by the way, don't ever do this, but this would be an example of a red herring, okay? Imagine that you get pulled over for speeding in a school zone. And you were trying to get out of your ticket. What red herring might you employ to the officer in order to try to distract him from your guilt? What red herring might you employ to the officer in order to try to distract him from your guilt?
Haven't you ever sped before?
Well, I'm not out killing anybody. I'm not robbing any banks. I'm not the real criminal. Now, is it true that you weren't robbing anybody or killing anybody? Yeah. But is that the topic at hand? No. What's the topic at hand? You were speeding in the school zone. That is wrong. All right, another example. Imagine finding out that somebody in leadership at your local church was involved in a very public sin that they were not repentant of. And so you go to some of the other leadership and you say that you have witnessed so-and-so doing this thing. Now, previous to this conversation, you already followed what Matthew 18 says about going to the person and showing them their sin. So you're kind of trying to obey Christ in this, but now you're at the point where this person's not listening. And so to further Matthew 18, you're supposed to have other people come as witnesses to you, right? So imagine then that this person responds to you. Remember, this is the person that you're trying to get to come and talk to, the first person who's sinning. This person responds by saying something like this to you. Well, Jesus said, whoever is without sin, cast the first stone. You want to call this other person on sin, and they respond by saying, well, Jesus said, whoever is without sin, cast the first stone. So ask yourself a question. What's the topic at hand? What are we trying to deal with? Well, there's two things that are happening in Scripture. Jesus, these people were hypocritically trying to judge this woman according to the law. Was she sinning? Yeah, she was. But they were trying to do something differently than what Jesus requires of us in church discipline. So what's the topic at hand? The topic at hand, this person is not repenting from their sin, and Jesus has given us a protocol to deal with this particular person. Is your opponent staying on that topic? No. They're introducing some distraction into the argument in order to put this argument aside. Well, Jesus said he was without sin, cast the first stone. Can you guys see that? Okay. Any red herrings that... Kids are really good at red herrings too, by the way. But you're supposed to clean your room, Josiah. Well, I know, but justice is... blah, 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 blah. What is that? Red herring. All right, so, I don't know why I moved over here. To the last one now. So this is my favorite one of all time, which is reductio ad absurdum. So again, this is Latin. Anybody know what that means?
Reduction to absurdity.
Now this is not a fallacy. This is actually something that you can do in your argument to show that their argument is fallacious. And this is, like I said, my favorite. So this, in this type of argumentation, this is what you do. There's a three-step process to it. First of all, you identify your opponent's premise.
And this is difficult sometimes because he's not easy to say, well, here's my premise. And then he lays it out. No, he's making a statement and you have to think about it, unpack it in your mind and say, okay, so the principle governing his statement is thus, right? So secondly, you have to take that premise for a test drive. And then thirdly, you expose it. When you take it for a test drive in the second step, what you're trying to see is that if there is any absurd implications of this particular view, right? So, what's one of the most cliche reductio ad absurdums that happened with our kids sometimes? You know, our kid will say something like this, but Dad, all of my friends are doing it. So what's the governing premise? But Dad, all of my friends are doing it. Doesn't matter what it is. All of my friends are doing it, Dad. So what's the governing premise? That thing is a good thing to do because all of my friends are doing it. Right? So take it for a test drive then, secondly. Does it follow, remember the non sequitur from last week, does it follow that because all of his friends are doing it, that therefore it is good? No. So you expose it. So then what do we say? Well, if all your friends were jumping off a cliff, would you jump off a cliff too? So that's one of the most, you know, famous reductios that we don't know that it's a reductio, but that's what it is. That's what reducing the thing to the absurd means. And guess what? Jesus used the reductio ad absurdum in Scripture. In Matthew 12, verses 22 through 27, we read the following. Then a demon-oppressed man who was blind and mute was brought to him, and Jesus healed him, so that the man spoke and saw. And all the people were amazed and said, "Can this be the son of David?" But when the Pharisees heard it, they said, "It is only Beelzebul, the prince of demons, that this man casts out demons." Knowing their thoughts, he said to them, "Every kingdom divided against itself is laid waste, and no city or house divided against itself will stand. If Satan casts out Satan, he is divided against himself. How then will his kingdom stand? And if I cast out demons by Beelzebul, by whom do your sons cast them out? Therefore, they will be your judges." So first of all, let's identify the premise. Jesus was casting out demons, and they said, "Yeah, you're casting out demons by the prince of demons." So what is the premise? Again, these premises are hard. I had to think about this for a little while, okay? So I'm thinking, one of their basic premises is that Jesus is performing exorcisms in order to deceive the crowd. You're casting out demons, all right, but you're doing it for these reasons, and you're doing it by the power of Satan himself, right? So let's take that premise for a test drive. Can a demon who opposes his own actions succeed in carrying out his own actions? Law of non-contradiction, right? Can I succeed in carrying out my actions when I oppose my own actions that I'm trying to carry out? No. It's a total contradiction. So then you expose it. And this is exactly what Jesus did. Knowing their thoughts, he said to them, "Every kingdom divided against itself is laid waste, and no city or house divided against itself will stand. If Satan casts out Satan, he is divided against himself. How then will his kingdom stand?" So what did Jesus do? He not only identified his opponent's premise, but he took it seriously. And he said, if that's the case, then your kingdom will never stand. And he showed the absurdity of it. He reduced the premise to its core principle and then showed how it is completely absurd. Alright, so let's look at some examples. So this is called... So let's look at some examples regarding abortion. This is called the modified pro-choice position. This is the person who doesn't want to say, well, I'm totally for abortion. They want to play both sides of the fence. They'll say something like this. And by the way, this is what John Kerry said in the 2004 presidential election. He said something like this. Well, I'm personally against abortion, but I think women should have the right to choose. Doesn't that sound like, gosh, you're personally against abortion? How do I argue against that? Good grief, right? So first, remember, instead of making a statement, ask a question. What question should you ask Mr. Kerry at this point? You should say this, or ask this. Why are you personally against abortion? And if a person is against abortion, generally their reason is, and they'll almost always answer, well, because I think it takes the life of an innocent baby. In other words, I think it's murder. Right? So hopefully you can already see how absurd this is already getting, right? All you need to do is expose it. So repeat back to them their view in your own words now. So let me get this straight. I think I understand your position. You think that abortion is wrong because you think it takes the life of an innocent child, but you think women should have the right to murder their own baby. And then they'll often say something like this. Well, if you put it that way. Well, what do you mean if I put it that way? If I didn't understand your position, then maybe you can tell me again and I'll try again. But, see, they can't have their cake and eat it too. It's impossible. Right.
Which, I guess murder is not abuse in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, murder is not, yeah, exactly. That's the insane thing. Well, that borrows then on the next example. Kokel in that book Tactics, he talks about this tactic called trotting out the toddler. And basically the idea is that any justification that's good for killing an unborn baby can also be used for killing a child. So, well, abortion is better than the life of abuse. On top of the absurdity that you already pointed out, then you could point to a 2-year-old and say, well, this child's already getting abused right now, so maybe we should kill that baby too. Or this 6-year-old, or this 10-year-old. Let's just stop their life right now because that would save them from the life of abuse that they're suffering. What's that?
I think you're thinking of like a
mercy killing of some kind. Right. Right. Absolutely. So, oftentimes when you're applying the reductio ad absurdum, when the words are coming out of your mouth, when you're doing this exposed thing, you realize that your very words sound absurd. And sometimes your opponent will say, that's absurd. And then you can simply respond by saying, I know it is. But if this implication follows from your principle, then it's not my statement that it's absurd, it's your principle that's absurd. You know, if it follows. An example of this is, even in the whole gay marriage argument right now that's happening. The government is seeking to redefine marriage in order to accommodate homosexuals in this country, right? Well, what are they doing? They're changing the definition of A. A no longer equals A. A equals whatever we want it to be, right? So, what's the principle? The principle is marriage is not simply between a man and a woman anymore. It's between whoever you love, whoever you have a dear relationship for, right? Well, what if I want to marry my 5-year-old son? Or my dog? Or my computer? Now, those are absurd things to say, but if it follows from their principle, which it does, then my examples only are a manifestation of what they already believe. Who's to say you can't have group marriages? Incestual marriages. Same-sex group incestual marriages. And all of that gross stuff, no doubt. But if it follows from their principle, then it's their principle that's absurd.
His issue is that their own response is, well, no, you can't do that.
Right.
Where is the foundation that they're doing, you can't do that?
Right. Right. Absolutely. So, just to encourage you guys, this takes time to do this stuff, and it takes a prayerful heart and a patient mind. Because when you're in the heat of stuff, it's difficult to calm down and do this. So some of the best lessons I learned have been afterwards. After the conversation's over, reflect on it, think about it, how can I respond differently? And guess what? You'll get another opportunity. Because most of the arguments against Christianity are just recycled arguments. And so if you flub it up on the first one, you'll get a second chance, believe me. So we'll go ahead and finish there. And if you guys have any questions...